1 o'clock, so we'll go ahead and get started. Today, colleagues, we're moving into the school funding issues, and we'll spend the day delving into a couple of school funding issue bills with regard to high growth districts, and then we'll also come back and revisit House Bill 2450, which we've heard a couple of times already. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2338 and 2440. And we'll invite Legislative Revenue Office to give us a brief summary, and we welcome Representative Crummell here.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2338 adds a new high growth grant within the school equalization formula for distribution of the state school fund. To qualify for the grant would require a growth rate of 4% or higher in average daily membership in the prior 5 years, and it makes the district grant equal to $2 million. And Sherwood is the only district that I know of that would qualify with those conditions. So it would receive an extra $2 million a year, and all other school districts that much less. House Bill 2440 deals with urban renewal agencies, and it would allow school districts to activate urban renewal agencies and adopt urban renewal plans for the purpose of improving schools and constructing new schools. That's the activity that the measure is, that the school districts are limited to. It redefines blighted areas to include dilapidated, outdated, or inadequate school facilities, and it would restrict the urban renewal area to the school district, and it allows the school board by ordinance to adopt or to activate an agency and adopt a plan. And that would have no direct impact until school districts took some action to initiate urban renewal agencies and plans, and then it would have the same property tax consequences as any other urban renewal area.
Thank you very much. Representative Crummell, thank you for coming. You've honored us by taking time out of your schedule. I know you're busy schedule today, and so we'll go ahead and turn time to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26. And I will try to be very brief, because what I'd really like to do is for you to have the opportunity to hear from Dr. Rob Saxton, who is the superintendent of the Sherwood Schools, and he can address some of the issues that a high-growth district that meets the triggers that are in House Bill 2338 can actually face. But with regards to House Bill 2338, it is a high-growth grant set up for schools. It has a $2 million price tag in it, and I think that there are ways that we can find those dollars so that we can have as little impact on the school state, on the state school fund as possible. The other thing is that it just kind of a technical thing is that it changes the census dates to March 15th, and the bill would start with the 05-06 distribution of state school funds. This is a tool that I think our high growth districts could really use, and in Sherwood's situation, what's real interesting is I know there's a lot of talk about sort of the perfect storm, but one of the things that Sherwood has faced is the issue of they have fast-growing student population, trying to figure out how they can get everybody hired to teach all these kids that are showing up at their door, and at the same time they are also, and Dr. Saxton has a chart that will show this, but they also are faced with being the lowest funded per student school district in the state. And so, consequently, they are still being penalized, quite frankly, for actions that the community took in the 1980s when the community of Sherwood was very supportive of the schools and property tax was the primary way that schools were paid for. And in that particular situation, then when equalization came into being in 1993, Sherwood was penalized, and they've continued to be penalized, and they're still penalized today. They're penalized 15 years after Measure 5 has passed. They are continuing to be penalized, and I don't think that's right. I guess maybe we ought to pass that on to somebody else. Hopefully not one of your districts that is represented here at the dais. So that's what I'd like to say about 2338. With regards to House Bill 2440, what I'm trying to do here is come up with a tool that our school districts that are growing fast and are in high growth, whether they're metropolitan or any area for that matter, but if they're facing growth, they need to be able to shorten up their window of planning. Currently for a school district, if they want to build a school in 2008, if they didn't start planning that in about 1998, they are already behind. If they want to build a school now in 2014, if they haven't started their planning today, they're behind. It's about an 8 to 10 year window of planning time that they need. What I'm trying to do is see if we can't shorten that time frame, shorten that up a little bit, so that their planning time window could be more like about 4 to 6 years, which I think is a little bit more reasonable when you're trying to figure out where you're going to put public facilities. But it would be a tool that the school districts can use. There's nothing mandatory in it that says that they have to use it, but it's a tool that they could utilize. And the way I envision this is that they would be able to say, take for example, an attendance area of a school or a proposed school, designate that as an urban renewal district, and then they would be able to utilize the incremental tax funds that come in from the growth that naturally occurs in that area. They would be able to collect those tax dollars and put those into bonds for building their facilities. The great thing about it is that it has a defined period of time. It's either defined by the amount of money that they're going to collect, or it's defined by a time period. So they could say they're going to run this for 10 years or 15 years or whatever the case may be, or until they collect X number of dollars. And that X number of dollars would be the amount of money to build that particular school. The thing is they could then bond, because they have that tool, and if they put that into place, they could then bond against the anticipated revenues. And they can, because they can bond against the anticipated revenues, they can actually get the money to build the schools sooner. And for a district that's growing at the kind of a pace that Sherwood is, or that Beaverton is, or that Redmond is, or that some of the other areas particularly in the metropolitan area, they're going to have the opportunity to shorten up that planning time frame. The biggest advantages is that this is a bill that will allow for growth to actually pay its own way relative to how the schools are done. It does not raise any taxes. It has a specific ending date. I mean, not the bill doesn't, but an urban renewal type of plan has a specific end date. It significantly raises funds for school rehab and construction. There is not another tool out there, and I know there's been some talk about using systems development charges and that sort of thing, but Mr. Chair and members of the committee, SDCs will not raise the kind of funds that an urban renewal type of plan can raise. And then it also will... It maintains requirements of approval by adjoining tax districts. So actually a school district that wants to utilize this tool is going to have to go talk to their city. They're going to have to go talk to their county. They're going to have to go talk to some of the other taxing districts in their area or in the area that they're proposing for an urban renewal plan. They would have to go talk to those taxing districts, not necessarily get their approval. Well, actually, they would have to get their approval, talk to them, get their approval, and if there's negotiations that need to go on, it opens the doors for those negotiations to go on. What some of the disadvantages of the bill is that it does not address replacement in areas that don't have any growth, and that's I recognize that that's an issue, and it does not address increased costs of operations. But I think that there's an amendment that we could do to this bill that would allow that. I do know that Representative Wisnett is going to be here to testify as well. I also know that he has a couple of bills that may go in tandem with these bills, and if that were the case and the chair were so inclined that you wanted to appoint a work group to sort of flesh this out and bring back a proposal to the committee, I know he would be interested in that, or I think he would be. He can speak for himself. I would be interested in that kind of a work group also, Mr. Chair, and be willing to work on that, and we can forge a solution to some of these problems that we're facing, and also with regards to the going back to the high growth grant for a moment, how we actually fund that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to stop, and if you'll indulge me to introduce Dr. Saxton to go ahead and give some testimony on these two bills, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Representative Kremel. Representative Gene Wisnett is here, and we'd encourage
and invite Representative Wisdom to come forward and sit with you, Representative Crummell. And Representative Wisdom, protocol is that you have the next slot on our agenda. Well, we have we're presently in public hearing on House Bills 2338 and 2440.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, honorable committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to speak, and the superintendent and I talked earlier, and I would appreciate the opportunity to go ahead and make my testimony and return to my committee meeting. HB 2338 and HB 244 that Representative Crummell has talked to you about, I think, are good bills that are trying to address high growth areas and the need of those high growth areas to provide timely funding for schools and also capital construction. And as the representative discussed, I have discussed with the chair and also the Republican members of this committee my bill 2650, which proposes the elimination of funding school districts which have declining enrollment. First, the percentage of schools with declining enrollment is now over 67%. Thus, Oregon school districts with declining enrollment have become the norm. Also, the cost of the school fund school year 2005-2006 is $58 million for students now in the classrooms, which are called within the education community phantom students. In fact, the schools with rapid growth are supporting these phantom students. This bill, HB 2650, is a huge step towards increasing the efficiency of education funding and eliminating what amounts to funds to educate students not in the classroom. I have a second bill that the chair is not aware of, or the committee members is not aware of, and I guess this has been presented in the legislature before. My bill is called HB 2964. And this bill would capture the increases in property taxes dedicated to schools for new constructions and require that money to be distributed to the school districts for capital projects. This bill would effectively provide more direct and timely funding of property taxes charged or collected in school districts and will direct such funding to school districts over urban renewal plans and areas where both parties have an interest and claim to the funds. Chairman Butler, I believe all these bills, my two bills and Representative Crummell's bills, will help school districts with rapid growth and find ways to finance new schools and capital improvements. I encourage you and this committee to form a working group to consider the merits of all four of these bills and devise appropriate practical ways to achieve meaningful and helpful objectives of all four bills.
Thank you very much, Representative Wisdom. Are there questions of either Representative Crummell or Representative Wisdom at this time? Thank you again. If either of you need to return to your other committee assignments, welcome to do that. And at this time, Rob Saxton.
Yes, I'm Rob Saxton, superintendent of the Sherwood School District, and Chair Butler, I appreciate the opportunity, and members of the committee, and especially Representative Comp, an ex-classmate of mine.
Yes.
Appreciate the opportunity to address this group today. I want to start off just by talking about the situation involving the Sherwood School District, and certainly I'm here to talk about high-growth districts and per-student funding, and also funding for bricks and mortar, so 2440 and 2338 are appropriate. I want to start off just by referring to a map that's on the overhead projection unit over here to my right and to your left, and I'm going to start off. This is a map that was produced by Metro when they were looking at the last boundary adjustment for lands to bring inside the urban growth boundary. The reason I want to point this out is I want to make sure and explain to you that Sherwood has grown, is growing, and will continue to grow. My point here simply is that on the map you'll see a line right here down the side. This line right here is I-5. And actually the entire map is here, and if we unfolded it, you could see the Metro exception lands that Metro is talking about. Anything that is pink on that map is called a Metro exception land. It's the land that Metro says is most likely to come inside the urban growth boundary in their next adjustments. And the green lands are very unlikely, and the light pink is slightly less likely than the dark pink. If you look inside there, inside the Sherwood School District, and this pink area, this one, this and this are all inside the Sherwood School District. Those are all lands that have been identified by Metro as lands to come inside the urban growth boundary sometime in the near future in the next few adjustments. You can see Sherwood proper is the white here in the middle. And if all of the land area came in that is slated as exception lands, it would probably just about triple Sherwood. One of the most startling things when you unfold this is that on the west side of I-5, there is more exception land inside the urban growth boundary in the Sherwood School District than in all other districts combined. So again, on the west of I-5, you could have Forest Grove, Tiger Tualatin, Beaverton, all of those districts combined within the Sherwood School District, there is more land likely to come inside the UGB. Now, that's not true on the east side, but there's got to be some west side growth. So I'm going to make the assumption that indeed those lands will come in and that the size of Sherwood and Sherwood's growth will continue. I'd like to show you a graph just real quick historically. I said that Sherwood is, has, and will grow. I don't know how well this is going to show up there. Yeah. So I'll just throw up some hard numbers up there, but if you take a look at the numbers that exist on that sheet, you'll see that Sherwood in 1992, and I think this is in the pack that I gave you also, we had 1,487 students. This year we started the school year with 3,596. The next sheet in your packet, well, I guess I would tell you this. This is work that's done by a demographer. We hire a demographer. Her name is Judith Varmack, and she looks at projected growth rates for the Sherwood School District 5 years out into the future. So the numbers that I'm showing you here today aren't just some guesses or conjecture. It's good scientific work done by a demographer that the district holds. And you'll see that her projection for the Sherwood School District in the next 5 years is a growth rate of just over 25%. And if you take that out to, that goes out to 2009, and this would be a representation of what our growth is going to look like from 92 to 2009, you'll see that we've gone from 1,487 students in 92 to projected 4,525 students in 2009. I think it's likely that the population in Sherwood has gone from 3,000 to 15,000 over that time span, and it's likely to go to 30,000 in the next 10 years. So certainly we've grown, we are growing, and we think that we're going to continue to grow, which were my opening statements. The other piece of information I'd like to refer you to is a long list of per student funding levels. It looks like this is probably the front on the packet that I gave you. And this has to do actually with spending that districts have done. And this one is for the 2002-2003 school year. I would tell you that what you would see from in the 2000 2002 would not be significantly different, and my understanding is that one just was released within the last couple days for 2003-2004. If you go to the far right column and run down that list, that is, this far right column is the amount that students or that schools spend per student or that districts spent per student in 2002-03. If you run down that column and look in the thousands place, there's 198 school districts represented, you will see that there are only two districts that have a five in the thousands place. Sherwood and Central Point School District are the only two school districts that spent under $6,000 per student in 2002-03. I would tell you that the data that's released yesterday actually has us spending instead of the 5,845, I think, in the next year in 2003-04, we spent $5,813 per student. So we actually spent a little bit less last year than we did the previous. If you take Central Point, which is the next closest school district, at $5,961 in spending per student, that's a difference of $116 per student. That's 2% of Sherwood's budget. At 4,000 students, which is our extended ADMW next year, that's $464,000 that we do not have in our budget, and that is the next closest district in spending per student. I forgot to show you this graph. This one always excites me.
Oh, no, that's not it.
This graph is City of Sherwood housing submissions. It's the number of the housing submissions that the City of Sherwood has. You can see that the most on record prior to last year was 1995 at 313. This was updated on October 1st. I would tell you that there were another 100 and some submissions in 2004. We have 525 housing submissions in the city of Sherwood for next year. Our growth will directly follow after that because those homes will be built over the next 1 or 2 years. So again, we're going to continue to grow. There are a number of factors that come into place when we start talking about school funding. I've tried to create a list of all the factors in the formula, and what I would tell you, and my point here is simply this, there are factors to address all kinds of issues in the funding formula, except high growth. In the last session, there were changes in the funding formula. In the session before that, there were changes in the funding formula. In the session before that, there were changes in the funding formula. But none of them have ever been made to address high-growth districts. There is average level of teacher experience. I'll talk about that one for just a second. In a district like Sherwood, where we're growing rapidly, we're hiring new teachers. And when you hire new teachers, typically they have a smaller level of experience. They have less years of experience as teachers than they do in other districts. The state average in teacher experience is 13.14 years. In Sherwood, it's 10.02 years. So the average teacher in the state of Oregon has taught for 13.14 years, and in Sherwood, it's 10.02. Districts receive $25 less per student for every year you are that your teacher experience is below the average. So in Sherwood, that means that we receive $78 per student less because our average teacher experience is 3 years less. The total amount to our budget next year, that's 1.6% of our budget, by the way, that's $317,000. And the reason I continue to go back and say percent is because I think that the percent is the important amount, not how much it is, because it's all relative. If we were Beaverton or Portland, it would be relative. It's 1.6% of budget. And so that's an important one to us, and it's one of the reasons that we're able to spend less per student. The other one is extended ADMW. And extended ADMW is in the formula, and what it means is that a district gets to choose the higher of the two enrollments from any 2 years, so the previous year or the current year. Well, because we're growing, we always choose current year because it means we have more students. Had we lost students, had we actually shrunk in size, we'd choose the previous year. And in fact, 68% of the districts in the state choose the previous year because they had more students the previous year, which means that they receive funding for students that are not attending their schools. And it really is a twofold hit for us because they're getting money for students that aren't there because they shrunk over the course of a year. And that means that because they are counted and we're going to divide the pot by how many students there are in the state, the amount that we get per student goes down. So it's twofold. Districts actually get money for students that they don't serve. They're able to maintain programs for students that aren't there. And our district gets less because the pot is divided by more. And so we get less for students that are there, which is really a big problem. Those are two areas of the funding formula. Some other funding formula areas: special education, English as a second language, pregnant and parenting teens, high poverty, remote small school, non-remote small school, neglected and delinquent students, elementary school districts, high school school districts, high cost disability, elementary school districts, and the transportation grant. Two of those were changes from last year, or last session, high cost disability and transportation grant. And the transportation grant, you can have a 70% reimbursement, an 80% reimbursement, or a 90% reimbursement based on your transportation costs. And I would tell you that the Sherwood School District loses in every funding formula factor that I just mentioned. And it's one of the reasons that we're the lowest funded school district, or lowest spending school district in the state. And I say spending because it is how much we spend per student, simply because we don't have the dollars to spend. There are some costs associated with high growth districts that other districts do not incur. We obviously have to hire additional staff. Textbooks. If our district grows by 300 students next year, we need to buy, if we're going to have every student have a textbook, we need to buy not just the textbooks that are up for adoption, but we need to buy 300 English, math, science, social studies, second language, and whatever other textbook that we have that we give kids to use so that they can do a good job and we can do a good job of teaching them. Technology. If we're going to have a ratio of students to computers, we need to buy technology and the licenses that go along with that. Buses. We continually have to buy more buses every year. Bus routes. We have more routes because we have more students to pick up. Materials and supplies, certainly. And one of the big ones, and this is something that our district faces next year, is portables. Next year, our school district will install 18 portable classrooms. There's nothing in the funding formula that talks about how to fund portables. Nor do you typically go out for a bond to put in portables because it's a relatively small expense as compared to building a whole other school. But we're putting those in. It's about $40,000 per classroom, which is $720,000 out of our operations, out of dollars that we could spend to operate next year. On top of that, we have to put furniture in those, and so the total amount to our district next year is about $1 million. And those are dollars that we just have to come up with out of the dollars that are allocated to us from the state. So there are no additional dollars. So there are expenses that are incurred when you're a high-growth district. The next thing, and this speaks probably more closely, well, both 2440 and 2338, but certainly 2440, is I know that sometimes people say to us, well, you know, Rob, why don't you just go out for a local option? Surrounding school districts do go out for local options, and that's absolutely true. We've always had fabulous support from people in our community. But this is a graph representation of where we are currently on bonds. The Sherwood School District has two bonds, one from 92 and one from 98, and we have to go out for another one in 2006. All of our schools are at capacity or within 1 year of being at or over capacity, hence the 18 portable classrooms that we're going to add next year. And so you can see that when we go out in 2006, this is a projection for a $60 million bond, which is very conservative given the high cost of construction. We actually probably need to be out for about a $70 million bond, which is going to drive our cost up to, at the 60, we're at about 4.25. It's going to drive our cost just for bonds up to about $4.50 a thousand. It costs us about 33 cents for every $10 million. In dollars. And that would be great, you know, if that was the situation. We thought that that was going to be the end. But if you look out here in 2013, which is a year that we have a bond drop-off, we need to be out again because of our current growth rate. If you look at the demographers' projections that I provided you, you'd see that we need to be out for more schools in 2013. And so even when we get out here, we're going to stack another probably $1.50 per thousand on top of that, and we're going to be right out at about $5 per thousand. In order to generate any real money for a local option, it would cost us a dollar per thousand, which would generate about $1.5 million for us in operating funds. That would put us out at $650 a thousand on top of the $481 that people pay all the time anyway, and I just don't think that we're going to get there. If we're going to have the buildings that it takes in order to, in our current scenario where we have to be out for bonds, we just can't get out for a local option and think that we're going to have taxpayer support for that. It isn't reasonable, and it wouldn't be fair to the community or to our taxpayers. Last, I wanted to show you some comparisons on our funding level. And I just happened to choose some districts that I thought you would find interesting. I have the Woodburn School District. Woodburn in 02-03 spent $8,709 a student. That's $2,864 more per student than the Sherwood School District spent in that same year, 49% more. And if you run down the list, you can see the districts that I've chosen. Let's just go to the bottom and not make me go through all of those or make you listen to me go through all of those. Down to the bottom to Beaverton at $6,290 per student. That's an 8% gap compared to what we have in our budget, and that's all funded by the state. That's $445 per student. That would be $4 million into our budget. Now, I just want to make this point. Can you imagine, if you look at this list, going to your districts and saying, we're going to cut your budget next year by the percent that's in the far right column? Because we operate on that amount every year. We operate on 8% less, 9% less, 10% less, and 49% less than the districts that you all represent every year. And the reason is because there's nothing in the factor, in the formula, for high-growth districts. And we need some relief. 85% of a school district's budget goes to staffing. And the cost of a teacher across this state is nearly the cost of a teacher across this state. I mean, they cost about the same in order to fund. And so there is a basement at which a district, you know, where a district needs to be funded in order to be able to operate. and that amount is not the amount that the Sherwood School District spends. Last thing I would leave you with is just this, because I wouldn't want you to have a misconception. The Sherwood School District, students in the Sherwood School District perform exceptionally well. We rank at one of the very top districts in the state as far as student performance is concerned. We're very conservative fiscally. I think that we've managed the funds that we have very well, or we couldn't survive on $5,845 a student. And I'm really proud of the work that the people in our district have done and the kind of support that we do get from our community. So I don't want to leave an impression that things are falling apart in the Sherwood School District. They're not. But as far as an issue of fairness and really being able to give the kids in our district what they deserve and the dollars that our taxpayers pay, there needs to be some kind of a factor in the formula, and we need some help as far as buildings are concerned, because you can see that we're going to have to be out for a bond about every 5 years, and because bonds take 20 years to pay off, we're going to have four stacked one on top of another, and I just don't think our taxpayers should have to support that. I don't know if there's any questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sexton. Questions? Go right ahead, Mark.
Thank you. First of all, have you tried to go out for a local option?
District made an attempt to go out for a local option in the fall of 2000.
It failed.
And it failed.
I am more sympathetic to the high growth district issue than a lot of people in the legislature, and I come from an area that has high growth, although evidently not as high as Sherwood's. But I do understand this. In addition to the high growth problems, most of those places are located in areas where real estate in Washington County is $300,000 or $400,000 an acre, compared to a tenth of that in Coos Bay, for example. And so there are a lot of issues. But I have a hard time saying, yes, we'll take money out of the formula and give it to one school district. And going back to my constituents who have voted for a local option and passed it through, and saying, by the way, we're going to take some money out of the state school support fund to help this one district, even though they didn't have the support for their schools that you did. You know, I do want to help Sherwood and all of the high-growth districts, but that is the dilemma that legislators are faced when all you do is tweak the formula a little bit. And I was just wondering what your comments are to that dilemma.
Thank you, Representative Hosh. I appreciate your points are very well taken, and I think that, they're right there. I guess a couple different things. One would be that there has to be relief on one front or the other. We're caught in a double whammy, and it is that we've got to pay for more buildings. And I just don't know how we would have four bonds stacked one on top of another, which is what we're going to have, and then also go out for a local option and have five different tax measures on the books that Sherwood taxpayers are having to pay for, when, by the way, Sherwood taxpayers pay a very significant amount of taxes, both in income and property. Tax already. I mean, they do, just by nature of the folks that are living in Sherwood. And so we have to have relief one place or the other. We either have to have relief in bricks and mortar, or we've got to have relief on per student funding. Because to ask our taxpayers to have five different tax measures that they pay for a school district, I just don't think that is reasonable for us to ask for that, and I don't think that they'll support it. As supportive as they are of our schools, and they are very supportive.
Could I get just a brief amount of the history of that local option? Again, that was for what dollar amount, and what did it fail by?
I was not the superintendent in Sherwood at the time we went out for that local option, so you're going to have to cut me just a little bit of slack as far as accuracy. I think that was $1.15 per thousand. And it failed by about 4%.
Okay. Representative Berger is recognized.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
A couple of questions. This proposal, I mean, I'm very familiar with this concept of the grant, this has a tipping point at 4% growth and some other characteristics in it. Are there other districts that you know of that approach this? And under this particular proposal, if another district tipped in, then the $2 million would be have to be divided between you according to ADM. Is that how this works? This is sort of a mechanical question, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if it's all right, I'll take that question, and then Dr. Saxon can chime in if he would like to. What would happen is that initially for the high growth grant there would be a designation of $2 million. Now, not necessarily all $2 million of that is going to go to Sherwood, but yes, if another district met the triggers or the tips, as you put it, that are in the bill for the high growth grant, then yes, the amount that $2 million would be the amount in the pot for high growth grant. So it would be divided among more school districts. Absolutely.
Follow up.
Yeah. Excuse me. So I'm clear. The $2 million then is it would all go to Sherwood under this bill.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Berger,
at this time,
yes. But it would, if you look at Section 2 on page 4 of it, what it talks about there is that it just describes a high growth grant is equal to $2 million, and Section B then is a school district shall receive a high growth grant if in each of the five prior fiscal years the school district had a growth in ADM of 4% or more over the previous fiscal year. The lead in to that entire statement there, I believe, goes back to and council would correct me, I'm sure, if I'm wrong on this, but the lead in to that goes all the way back to the beginning of section 2 at line 29 on page 1 and continuing on line 2 of page 2, and it says 3.2 or 327.013, the state school fund distributions for school districts shall be computed as follows. So it's not necessarily just one school district that's going to get the $2 million. Hey, if I could get Sherwood $2 million, would I do it? You're damn right I would. At the expense of the other school districts? Probably. I mean, I'm going to be real upfront about that. But the thing is that if you go back to this statement on page 2 and the lead in to what number 12 is, and if I've read that correctly, then it's going to be for any school district in the state. It's just that you have to hit those triggers in order to get any of the $2 million.
Let's get legislative revenue's take on it.
I was going to ask Steve how this.
Mr. Chair, I read that as $2 million per school district that
right.
qualifies.
No, mm-hmm. I read it too.
Yep. It's talking about the grant for each school district,
right.
And each school district could potentially qualify for $2 million.
Representative Berger?
Steve, are there other districts approaching this threshold, this tipping point, as I put it, or that you know of? I mean, I'm not...
But there's other school districts that have growth that exceed the 4%.
But not over...
For a year, but not over five consecutive years.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, I would add that we have made it somewhat strenuous because the one thing that we don't want to have happen is that, you know, one of the criticisms that I have of the state school fund and the formula that we have currently set up. I'm going to use the example of disabled students. It's said in there that at 11%, a district automatically gets money for disabled students. Name me one school district in the state that doesn't have 11%. Name me one district in the state that doesn't have 11% as the money that they put in to educate disabled students so that they can take advantage of that part of the formula. Name me one.
Rob? If I could add Chairman Butler in response to Representative Berger's question. There are a couple things. One would be, yes, I think Sherwood is the only district at this point in time. I do anticipate that there will be others certainly North Clackamas, Oregon City, Gresham, Barlow, Westland, Wilsonville, if you look at the metro adjustment, are all districts that I think in very short order will have 4% growth per year. Last, I would say that if the Sherwood School District did get the $2 million that is talked about in this bill, it would only close half of the gap that exists on per-student funding between Sherwood and Beaverton, one of the lower-funded districts in the state. And I think that you'll look, if you look, you'll see that high-growth districts, by and large, are low-funded. Currently, you know, Beaverton has an 8% gap. This $2 million would add 4% to our budget, and it would close that gap to only 4%. Still a very significant gap in the per-student funding we'd be able to make.
Representative Cohn.
Thank you for coming, Mr. Saxon. It's a pleasure to see you again. I'm just going to pick on you a little bit, and that is because what you've presented here is a very clear, distinct picture that many people don't understand about our funding formula. And it's a perfect example why we need to, hopefully, I talked to Chairman Butler that maybe we'll do an interim committee on the funding formula, because it is flawed, seriously flawed, and there is not equity in schools. But I would like for you to share for the people in this committee that, what's your student-teacher ratio at elementary?
Our student-teacher ratio at elementary is in the primary is 1 to 25, and the secondary it's, or in the intermediate it's 1 to 27.
And what's high school? Do you know off the top of
your head? 1 to 29.
Yeah. I'm just taking this moment because Rob Sachs and I are really good friends. But the reality is, you know, if everybody had a superintendent like Rob, we wouldn't be fighting and wondering where our money's being spent in schools, because a district with his conditions, they know where every penny is and all that. There's no, they are down to the bone and then some. And yet there are many districts that receive an adequate and above adequate amount of funding for their schools. And I will go on the record for that statement. And I applaud Rob and the Sherwood School District for the work they're doing.
Thank you, Representative Cohn. Additional questions? I just had a question relative to that last graph, the expenditure. Is that per ADM or ADMW, Rob? The 5,845.
ADMW.
Is that weighted?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
The very last graph that you presented, was that for ADM, the $5,845, or is that ADM weighted?
That is per student spending ADM.
ADM, okay. Representative Berger is recognized.
One last quick question. The other, and maybe Steve can answer this, the other piece of this legislation changing the May to March, what's the effect of that and the purpose?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I'll take another stab at that one, and then legislative revenue can correct me if I'm wrong. But what the effect is that by doing by backing the apportionment up by 2 months, the money will actually arrive at the in the wallet of the school district at about the same time that the student is showing up at the door. Actually, it'll still be a little bit of a lag time because, for example, school districts that choose the previous year's amount of money that they're getting on a per student basis, the money coming into the district, I believe, is based on the May 15th census, and by backing that up, the money arrives a little bit sooner. And I'll invite legislative revenue staff or Dr. Saxon to correct me if I'm wrong, and I have no problem if I am wrong. I just stand corrected.
Mr. Chair, members, that is a calculation that's done to the May distribution to adjust the December student count for when there is growth in the district. You adjust the December student count based upon what the relationship has been between December and June in the prior years. And so if those prior years have shown growth between those two dates, you use the average of those two dates to increase the December count, and then that becomes part of the funding dollars. And so this would just make that adjustment 2 months earlier.
Okay. So it's a timing issue for the districts. Okay, got it.
Further questions?
For the record, Chairman Butler, those figures, because we have charts here, because actually Representative Escobar came very prepared with some of the charts we've had from before, and that is just the average daily attendance. It's not average daily weighted attendance.
Right, right. I think he identified as the not weighted figure.
Right.
Further questions? Thank you very much. You might stay tuned, and we may get back with you.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Colleagues, we have House Bills 2338 and 2440 that are open for public hearing. We have signed up for 2338. Ken Hunsaker.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm Kent Hunsaker with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. And I thought the little piece that's coming around I'll talk about in a minute, but it actually provides you with, a really good perspective. We actually put this data together at the beginning of the year, thinking that we might have a use for it at the legislature, and so today we find a use for it. And I think it puts into perspective for you to look at all the school districts in the state in terms of growth and decline. This is a list of the school districts. It's over the last 5 years, so it only gives you 4 years of growth data. but it shows you the overall growth or decline in every district in the state. You'll notice I've circled Sherwood on the first page. And when we looked at this, Sherwood would be the only school district that meets the criteria of 4% growth over this period of time. You'll notice that there's a 3.6 on Woodburn. Woodburn is another high growth district, and they meet the criteria all of the years except the year that's 3.6. They're over 4 in all the others. One other thing that I would note is that you get some very, very small districts. So I'm going to take you to the very last page.
Get one speaker.
And show you that our reading of the bill also was that any district that had 4% growth over a period of 5 years, no matter their size, would get $2 million. I'll refer you to Diamond School District. And if you look at Diamond over the last, and keep in mind that in order for Diamond to have growth of 5%, all they need is about 0.3 kids. Okay? So I'm telling you, if I could get $2 million, I would find a way to get 0.3 kids each year. and I would recruit them from wherever. But I'm just saying that the bill, the way it's written, could apply to a very tiny district of 5 or 10 or 25 or whatever kids, and would then require that $2 million as a high-growth grant be given to those districts. I did want to comment a little bit on the funding formula, because I believe that the funding formula in general is what we've been talking about here today and the various pieces of that. One of the pieces that has not been talked about that was actually implemented for high growth districts was the facilities grant. And as you're aware, as a committee, that $8.5 million a year, $17 million in total in a biennium is put into a grant that provides funds for districts that build new facilities. And it was with the idea that it would provide money for such things as textbooks and furniture and things like that would go into those facilities. That grant is supposed to provide 8% of the costs of those facilities, up to 8%, and it's been running at about around 3 to 3.5 for the last while. So instead of getting 8, they're getting 3 to 3.5. One of the things that's very clear as we look across the state is that I pointed out that we have Sherwood with growth over 4%. We have Woodburn with growth over 4%, except for 1 year. We have Beaverton with growth around 2-3%. We have David Douglas with growth around 3 to 4, almost all the way through. And you know, one of the problems with taking a figure and saying that we're going to provide extra funding for 4%, then all of a sudden it starts going, well, what about us? We're 3.5. Well, what about us? We're 3. And what about us? We're 2.5, and so on. And what you do with any type of change in the funding form, you just start saying who's a winner and who's a loser. In this case, you have 197 losers and one winner. And as you fool with other parts of the formula, that very much comes to play. So I hope that the ADM weighted data will assist you as you look at these issues, because it's very clear the districts on here, there's about two-thirds of the districts are declining in enrollment. And I do want to speak to those, because I know that the issue of the whole idea of funding phantom students is a difficult one for some people. And I've been in a growing district, so I've felt some of the good things that happen with growing districts, and there are some. But with those that are declining, when you lose 25 kids, you lose $125,000. 25 times 5 is $125,000. And you don't lose $125,000 in expenses when you lose those kids. You might be able to have one less teacher, but I guarantee you that's not $125,000. So the rest of those costs have to be absorbed in the system somehow, and that's what declining districts are dealing with. I would point out that the opposite of that happens with growing districts. When you grow 25 kids, you get $125,000. You have to buy a teacher for them. You have to provide some materials. But that does not cost you $125,000. And it does leave some money in the system to do some other things. So, you know, just keep that in mind, too. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions for Ms. Hunsaker, Representative Berger, as recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the second time through with me to hear from Sherwood. Yeah. And I'm sympathetic, frankly. What suggestion do you have to address this for districts that are just in a real rapid student growth situation that would, what would help? What do you suggest?
Representative Berger, Chair Butler, the...
You don't have to set a policy right now. What kinds of ways do you think we should approach this is maybe a better way of asking this, because I don't want to put you on the spot here.
No, move him into the Hunsaker into Rob's position. How's he going to resolve it?
Yeah, actually, you know, it's a very good question. You know, and a part of our issue that we have is it's very difficult to address differences in funding when you don't have any new money. I mean, that's been the biggest problem that we've had for some period of time. If you could fund everybody at the same level and keep them going and then say, can we do this to address some things on top of that? Mm-hmm. But almost every time we fool with the formula, what do? We end up taking from here to give to over here, and we say that's a good thing. And what Rob is saying is the last session, what happened is that there were two pieces that came to the formula. One was the high-cost disability you're going to hear about later on today, and the other one was the transportation that raised transportation from 70 to 90. Neither one of those benefited Sherwood, and in fact benefited some very small districts that have high-cost transportation. So it is very, very difficult to talk about what you're going to do. Of course, my feeling of what should happen is that the facility grant is there for a purpose. It is for growth districts. You know, it was meant to fund 8% of the construction costs. It's too bad it doesn't do that. It would be the best way to actually deal with that, would be able to actually provide these districts with with the full what that was meant to do, which is provide 8% of construction costs.
Kent, would the facilities grant, could it be used for those portable classrooms?
Exactly. The way the facilities grant would work, you would take the cost of those instructional units, and you would get up to 8% depending on what was applied for, and your legislative revenue step. I believe the latest is 3.2. Is that correct? So I think it's 3.2 is now what that's funding. So that's exactly what it does. So if he was talking about $1 million, they would be eligible for up to $80,000, but they're really going to get closer to $40,000.
Okay. Further questions for Mr. Hunsaker?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I am very sympathetic to this issue, too. And, there are really no answers, is what I just heard you say. And I think it's important to point out that, I don't want to keep plugging Beaverton here, but there's high growth and there's high growth. Sherwood has 3,000 students, and while it grew at 4%, that's only in your graph here of 4 years. That's only 680 students. Right. Beaverton grew at a lesser rate, but it added 2,800 students in that time. We were building two schools a year. And whenever we get on this subject, and I'm like Representative Berger, second helping at this bill, there was never anything that anybody ever says can be done, other than add more money. That you can't just keep changing the formula. And it's really difficult for the school activists in Beaverton and in Sherwood to keep holding bake sales and trying to keep these things running and not, fall apart and in this sort of weary atmosphere that we have trying to keep schools running.
Chair Butler, Representative Haas, I think you bring up a really good point, and like I say, when you look across the system, we can talk about Beaverton's issues with growing 3,000 students. We can talk about Portland's issues with declining 3,000 students. They're both very, very significant issues. And how you deal with those, we have various aspects of the formula that deal with it. I would say to you that your funding formula, some may not like various aspects of it, is pretty fair in my estimation. I've been a superintendent for 25 years, and I teach a school finance class. I've looked at other states' formulas. You have a very good formula here. But there will continue to be issues with, what about me? I'm a little bit different from somebody else. Rob Saxon and Sherwood have a great case for they don't have a lot of needy kids to serve in that district. It's kind of the makeup of that community. So they don't have a lot of weighted students in the form of ESL kids, special ed kids, pregnant parenting kids, poverty factor kinds of things. You could go to Woodburn and say, okay, Woodburn is the highest per pupil, if you go. The reason they're there is look at their population. Look at that population they have to serve. And is it appropriate for them to have that much more funding to serve that population of kids? And our formula says that it costs more money to serve those kids. You're going to have to provide them different kinds of things. So, I would say your formula is a lot better than you think it is, just on the surface, in that it has functioned pretty well. Part of the problem we have with changing the formula, though, is when we do it without money, all we do is shift the money from one school district to another. Now, somebody said, name me one school district with less than 11% special ed population. I can name you a bunch. Medford is below. Tiger Tualatin is below. Sherwood is below. There are several school districts that are below the 11% in special ed.
Mr. Chair, if I could just quickly...
Yes, please follow up, Representative Haas.
As you know, Portland is going through a very painful situation now in closing some of its small schools. Do you think that maybe that is some component that we should add to the formula, that if a school gets under a certain definition, I don't know if it's geographic or size or what, that it should be closed? Or do you see a consolidation of any of the 196 districts as one possible answer to this issue that Representative Crummell brought to us?
Chair Butler, Representative Haas, that may be, that's probably the most difficult question to answer, because it's so oriented to the very district that it's in. And if, I was recently down in the Medford School District working with the school board there. And it just so happened that after the workshop with me, they were having a meeting at one of the local schools that they were thinking of closing down. So I went to the local gymnasium with 560 people in it that was supposed to only have 300 in it. And I was looking for the fire marshal, but he wasn't around. And so when you think about those issues, and you're finding the same thing in Portland, you're going to find it in Medford, you find it wherever they are talking about closing schools. And the same thing happens when you talk about combining districts, because usually that means that you're going to lose a high school that's very, very important to a community when you combine districts like that. I think that under the current funding, we are having more talk about some thinking around combining districts to get around this. There's quite a few places that are losing students so fast. On the coast, in the valley, I'm familiar with Lane County area. I look at Pleasant Hill. Pleasant Hill graduating 120 kids, having 60 come in kindergarten. Lowell right next door to them, very similar circumstance. Should Lowell and Pleasant Hill be talking? Well, if it wasn't for the high schools there, probably. Lowell has a great wrestling team. that those are very difficult issues. So I don't really have an answer to that in any way.
You've got to keep your priorities straight. Yeah. If you got a good wrestling team, you've got to keep the school open.
Yeah. Keep it.
Other questions of Mr. Hunsaker? Thank you very much, Kent. Appreciate you being here and your input. We get more and more questions. As we continue on, we do have public hearings open on the two bills, 2338 and 2440. We're going to continue on now with information on 2440. Colleagues, let's invite Jeffrey Cashmer, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeffrey Tashman, and I represent the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies, which is a statewide group of urban renewal agencies. And I guess I would like to start by saying that I don't think that there is a single individual member of AORA that is not concerned about school finance in the state, and I don't think that there's a single member of AORA that doesn't recognize the critical role that schools play, specifically in the realm of community building and making communities whole communities. We have some concerns about this bill that are strictly related to the particular method of tax increment financing used by a school district that we'd like to point out. Chapter 457 of Oregon Revised Statutes enables cities and counties to create urban renewal districts. And the reason that cities and counties are given that authority is that cities and counties are the districts that are most responsible for development within a community. They're the districts that regulate, and very largely they're the districts that invest. So they are general purpose governments, and they have the tools in their portfolio that can be used to promote development. Now, Chapter 457 enables cities and counties to use urban renewal to prevent and eliminate blight. Blight's kind of an old-fashioned word, but really now what it means is any condition that's preventing an area from developing according to how it's supposed to develop under the locally adopted comprehensive plan. Tax increment financing does allow an urban renewal agency to get revenue from the increase in property taxes in a defined area. But the basic connection there is that urban renewal agencies make investments in that area that creates the additional value to a varying extent. There are some urban renewal areas where you can look at it and say, none of this growth would have happened without the urban renewal investment. You can look in an area, another area, and say, some of this growth, or maybe even a lot of this growth, would have occurred with or without urban renewal. But the basic rationale for urban renewal is not just collecting the money that comes from growth, but making the investments that generates that growth to begin with. So school districts are not structured to make those kinds of investments. It's not part of their portfolio to do infrastructure projects or parks projects or other public facilities besides schools. So in that case, it is just a question of collecting the money that happens as a result of growth in an area. The final thing that I would like to point out is that urban renewal is a good tool for school district development where you can identify projects of common benefit between an urban renewal agency and a school district. So there are a lot of examples of urban renewal agencies building joint use facilities for K through 12 districts, playing fields, other facilities that can be used by the school district and the public. There are many cases of urban renewal agencies buying sites for new schools and conveying those sites to school districts, and these are within urban renewal areas, conveying those sites to school districts at less than their fair market value. And finally, there are urban renewal plans that take school district property that is surplus property and create development value for that property that would not have been there before, allowing school districts to sell that property at a much greater price than they would have otherwise. So while urban renewal is a good tool in the context of city and county urban renewal, we just don't feel it's the right tool for K through 12 school districts. And I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that you might have.
Jeffrey, what would be the income tax or the property tax effect of allowing House Bill 2440 to a small community that already had a renewal agency within the district?
Well, there are limits on how much property in a city can be in an urban renewal area. So I guess the first impact would be if for large cities it's 15% of their land area and assessed value, smaller cities it's 25%. And so the first impact would be, is there room within that limit for a school district urban renewal?
So if we already have a city the size of Portland that already has several, 10? Mm-hmm. I don't know, a lot of urban renewal areas.
That's 11.
11, okay. And let's say that we're approaching that.
And they are.
And then I bring this bill forward. Would I only then be entitled to include a very small portion of the school area then, or the city's landmass?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in that case, yes, it would be a very small area. There would be other...
So what I'm trying to get at is, would this then put me in conflict with actual urban renewal districts that are trying to remove the blight from the city and those urban areas?
You would have a conflict between future urban renewal districts and done by cities versus future urban renewal districts done by school districts, because everything has to fit within that limit.
Certainly. I guess that was my angst, that it could either limit those that are already there to any further expansion within their boundaries, which I understand they can amend their boundaries if they are within that 15%, and have the votes to do so. But then my concern is also that if a school came in and set up its own urban renewal for the benefit of the K-12 construction or the improvements on those schools, then it would put it in conflict with the true intended consequence of trying to build out of the blighted area that they may be trying to overcome. Now, it's my understanding, and let me just check with Legislative Revenue, that this has nothing to do with necessarily the way we've been defining blighted areas in the past. As a matter of fact, I think it redefines blighted areas in the bill, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, yes, it does. And if you look on page 2 of the bill, lines 5 and 6, there's a sub J. That is part of the blighted areas definition.
This describes most of my school. Yeah. Okay. Representative Berger?
Well, a couple of quick questions, if you don't mind.
Please,
first,
Paula.
Do you know of any other states that do an urban renewal district for school construction?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I personally don't, but my knowledge of other states is pretty limited, so there could be such a case.
But my fundamental question is this. I've always seen urban renewal and tax increment financing as a function of time. You get your bond authority because of as time passes, thus values go up, and it takes a few years, and yet when we're hearing about the need for school facilities in a growth area,
mm-hmm.
It's also a function of needing it sooner rather than later. I'm asking sort of how this sort of urban renewal thing, what kind of a turnaround would you have to have on your property increments in order to get enough to build, say, a $40, $50, $60 million high school?
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe you're correct. It is the most challenging part of an urban renewal plan is at the beginning when the revenues are low, and it does take time to, even if you're selling bonds against your revenues, it still takes time to raise any significant amounts of money.
Further questions of Mr. Tashman? Thank you very much, Mr. Tashman. Appreciate it. We also have signed up for House Bill 2440, Hacinas Juarez, Kyle Gorman, and Alex Jensen. Gentlemen, don't mind joining Hacina, and she'll play the rose, and you guys go ahead and play the thorns.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hacina Squires here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. We represent approximately 900 special service districts providing services like water, sewer, fire, irrigation, parks and recreation across Oregon. To that extent, our membership consists of approximately 260 rural fire protection districts throughout the state who are whose main sources of revenue come from property taxation and are drastically affected by the ability to levy or the inability to levy property taxes. To my right today with me is Kyle Gorman, the executive officer of Clackamas County Fire District Number 1, and to my left is Alec Jensen, the executive officer for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, which is located in Washington County. I want to make it very clear that our association does not oppose urban renewal districts. We're not here to say urban renewal districts are a bad thing, but we do have some concern regarding the impact on property taxation that they have for overlapping taxing jurisdictions like special service districts, and with the potential creation of ability for school districts to form urban renewal districts that would have an impact on special districts. I think our goal here is to put a little bit of a different face in addition to the school, to just to bring to your attention a bill that we'll be introducing along in this committee, House Bill 3380, which was dropped yesterday. The bill is printed as it will come out, will not be the final form. We'll be requesting some amendments. It didn't come back properly from legislative council.
That's a shock. When's that happened?
I'm so sorry, Dexter Johnson. I didn't mean that in a negative way. I did not get it properly. I mean that sincerely. It was not Dexter's fault, and it was because we just didn't have it all together prior to dropping the bill. So, I definitely need to recover on that because you know I'm Dexter upset. Anyway, House Bill 3380, the amendments that we will be seeking, that Dexter will be preparing at some point in the near future, the bill is dropped, only applies to Clackamas County. We'll be applying the bill statewide, and it will allow for, when an urban renewal agency is formed, allow for that municipality to upfront opt out school districts and rural fire protection districts from the provisions of the division of tax as they relate to urban renewal, right up front, voluntarily, not mandatory. And then the second provision will be a provision that, after the urban renewal agency has been in existence for 15 years, will permit by a school district or fire district board resolution, if the board finds that this, the urban renewal agency, by virtue of the division of taxes, so onerous and burdensome on the property taxation system for the revenue raising ability for the district, school, or fire, that they will be able to opt themselves out of the urban renewal district after a period of 15 years. We've testified before the Senate Revenue Committee with respect to Senate Bill 402, which is being considered in, on the other side of the chamber. Actually, we're over here on the Senate side, closer to the Senate than the House. And to that extent, I just would like to highlight to the committee that with respect to Senate Bill 402 and the discussion that's taking place in the Senate Revenue Committee, there is a work group that is has been put together by Senator Deckert to take a look at some of the issues that are circulating regarding urban renewal, and we're participating in that, and appreciate Representative Crummell, who is also a sponsor on our bill, House Bill 3380, to potentially maybe combine those efforts on that, both the House and Senate side. My goal today to bring both Alec and Kyle down was to just provide a little bit of a different spin as it relates to not only schools but to rural fire protection districts and how urban renewal agencies impact our taxing district. So with that, I'll turn it over to Kyle.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kyle Gorman. I'm the executive officer of Clackamas County Fire District Number 1. I want to speak to you today about some experiences that we've had with urban renewal. Alec Jensen has had ever so slightly different experiences, but suffice it to say that our experiences have not been positive. And when earlier Mr. Tashman spoke about the division of taxes and how urban renewal agencies receive money from division of taxes, they receive money from us largely, as well as a number of other overlapping districts. But our concerns are not so much about urban renewal. I think we believe in growth, appropriate growth. We believe in urban renewal, but we think there needs to be some boundaries on how urban renewal is applied. And in Clackamas County, at least, it has not been applied very effectively, in our opinion. We have engaged in more than two decades of debate with Clackamas County. We serve two urban renewal areas, the Clackamas Town Center area, Clackamas Industrial Area. Together, they're about 8 or 9% of the total AV of all urban renewal areas in the state of Oregon. So one fire district is serving a very significant part of urban renewal. In addition, we've learned that the county is intending to start two more urban renewal areas within our boundaries. So long term, we think this is the single most significant financial impact on fire protection that that exists. And believe me, it's significant. Both areas, one was started in 1981 and 1984. Both of them were intended to last about 5 years. Well, you remember the economy in the 80s. It was not very good. The Urban Renewal Agency came back to us after 5 years and said, can we extend it for another 5 years? We said, okay. We recognized the economy was bad. And at the end of that now 10-year period, the laws had changed, and they no longer had to come back and ask our permission to extend it. And since then, both urban renewal agencies have been extended. So now we're into the 25th year of one and the 21st year of the second. Our problem is that, unfortunately, urban renewal areas just simply never die. I mean, as we learned, it takes a while to generate any real income, and then after that real income starts to flow, it becomes very, very difficult for a public agency to wean itself off that income. Let me tell you how it affects us. Right now, 40% of our emergency responses take place within the boundaries of an urban renewal agency. About 10% of our revenue comes from the frozen base that's applied on that urban renewal agency. The impact is significant. In addition to that, as an example, the Clackamas Town Center area, the frozen base, the assessed value is about $36 million. The growth on that frozen base, the excess value, is over $409 million. Right now, we're serving the Clackamas Town Center for an assessed value of $36 million, basically 1980 prices, not COLA adjusted, and we've been doing so for over 25 years. Significant impact. We have in Clackamas County what I will refer to as an exit ramp economy. And what that means is that the urban renewal areas grow up around exit ramps. They focus on retail commercial development. They're successful in getting that retail commercial development. People move to the area because of that retail commercial development. And unfortunately, one of the unintended consequences is we find out later that you have traffic congestion, insufficient schools, insufficient fire protection, and other problems that create an area that's really not as nice to live in as was originally intended. So the result of that is to create another urban renewal agency to make transportation improvements and to build more infrastructure to allow a broader area of growth. So now we have this economic spiral, at least for the fire district, where it continues to get worse and worse and worse as more urban renewal areas are implemented. We have, and we're very sensitive to the issues that that the schools are in, and it was enlightening for me to hear some of the problems about that the schools are having, and I appreciate the comments by the school district proponents. Our problems have to do with the ability of the urban renewal agencies to go on forever, and as a result, we'd like to see some what the Senate refers to as sideboards put on urban renewal agencies, and that is 15 years. And we say 15 years because that matches the maturity of the structure that's built to as a result of the urban renewal area, with the maturity of the financing that's used to construct it. So you match your maturities, and we think 15 years is the right time frame. The second thing is to allow, right now, even if urban renewal agencies did not want to include a particular overlapping district, they have no choice. So the law does not authorize urban renewal agencies to opt us out, even if they want to. So we want to give the urban renewal agencies more authority and give them the authority to opt us out if possible. So with that, I'll answer any questions or turn over the microphone to Mr. Jensen.
Mr. Jensen, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Alec Jensen. I'm with Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. We serve 400,000 people in 9 cities and unincorporated areas of Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas County. We, too, have some urban renewal experience, and while it's not been altogether negative, it has the long-term potential of being so. And let me just speak a little bit on the positive light about urban renewal. We have two significant urban renewal projects in our area, the first of which is in Wilsonville, the Villebois community, which will essentially be Oregon's safest community. The fire district was able, through a relationship with the city of Wilsonville, convince the city that in exchange for our support of that urban renewal project, that every building in that community would be fully sprinkled. Again, that's relationship-based. Another relationship-based example is the considerations going into right now the West Side Commuter Rail Corridor project, where there's concurrent or consecutive urban renewal districts being considered. And in exchange, once again, for our participation and support, we're looking at funding for a fire station. We're looking at partial funding for the relocation of our administrative complex. And in both cases, over the long term, when the urban renewal projects are built out and the debt is retired, increased assessed value comes on the roll. So In the very long term, and sometimes these things go on for quite a while, the fire district becomes the beneficiary of increased assessed value. But again, I want to emphasize in Washington County, that's predicated on an excellent working relationship that we have with our cities and the county. Like Kyle said, we support the idea or the concept that municipalities and or the counties and the cities in this case could choose on the front end to opt us out. In the case of Wilsonville, we believe that Wilsonville probably would have opted not to have impacted the fire district. We had two relatively new fire stations in the community. There was nothing to be gained for the fire district, and had Wilsonville had that tool, we expect that they would have excused us. And so in the context of the discussion that Hasina referenced earlier relative to Senator Deckert's efforts, we're looking to achieve that kind of relief in that process. However, I want to give you kind of my oversimplified assessment of House Bill 2440, and without sounding like I'm necessarily opposing it, there's a couple of issues that I have. House Bill 2440 gives cities and counties the ability to opt themselves out, but there is no reference whatsoever to special districts. There is not the provision in there that allows special districts to be opted out, nor is there the provision in there that would allow the school district to opt out a special district. So we're in, and we're impacted regardless. Now, none of the revenues inured to the benefit of the Urban Renewal District can be used for any fire district related projects. No infrastructure gets built in the fire arena, and long term, there's no growth in assessed value. So again, without seeming to oversimplify the issue, House Bill 2440, from the standpoint of this special district, is simply tantamount to a policy decision to shift revenue from, in our case, public safety to schools. Now, I don't want to sound crash in that comment, because as a parent of children in the public school system, I agonize over the plight of public schools. But I don't think it's appropriate to use this tool to set those kinds of priorities. And I'll
thank you very much. So really, 2440 allows the cities and counties an opt-out provision, but not the special districts.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Questions then of these three folks on the panel? Hasina Squires, Kyle Gorman, Alec Jensen. Thanks again. We appreciate your testimony. The final person we have signed up is Michelle Dyser. Michelle?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, I'm Michelle Dyser with the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm going to go ahead and confine my comments to House Bill 2440, the bill before you today. I think Mr. Tashman stated a number of concerns that cities with urban renewal areas share as well. Mainly, will the construction of just school facilities generate the necessary increment and private investment to pay off these bonds in a timely manner? We would want to ensure that school facilities and other types of community development efforts are coordinated and integrated. And if you have two separate agencies that are working on two different sets of projects, I don't know how that's going to work. And secondly, Mr. Tashman mentioned that statute prohibits the overlap of boundaries. Committee members here discussed the fact that only a certain percentage of land can be in urban renewal at any given time, and a number of the high-growth areas that were being discussed today already have urban renewal agencies, including Sherwood, Wilsonville, Redmond, and Medford. Ms. Squires did mention that the Senate is considering Senate Bill 412 and has a work group that is discussing a number of urban renewal issues. And I think it's important that these sort of all be put on the table so that they can be considered in their entirety and the various impacts on what we currently have as a whole rather than on a piecemeal basis. So that's really all I have, just other than to reiterate the fact that a number of urban renewal agencies are working very closely with their school districts in terms of putting together project plans that are mutually beneficial. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michelle. Questions of Ms. Dyster? Thank you again, Michelle. I do have some questions, and I'm going to ask staff, but I'll do that when we have an opportunity to do that. With that, colleagues, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bills 2338 and 2440 and open the public hearing on 2450, House Bill 2450. Colleagues, 2450 is a House bill we've heard in the past. Steve?
Mr. Chair, members, 2450, as you recall, deals with two sunset dates that were put on legislation passed last session. One was the sunset for the high-cost disability grant and the fuel equalization formula. Last session, it was only made possible to be for the 2 years and then go away. The other one was to repeal, the other part that 2450 does is to repeal the sunset for the small high school supplemental fund. That's the $2.5 million a year that is outside the school equalization formula. And so the bill would continue that funding mechanism and continue the $2.5 million going to those small schools in small school districts for another, would continue it on indefinitely as it's drafted. So it basically maintains the status quo that was started last session for those two funding provisions and would continue them.
Okay. We've got some folks signed up. I'm not going to get the names right, but I'm going to go ahead and give it a try. Kent Hunsaker and Nancy Latini. Kent, we've heard from you already, but Nancy wrote your name down this time. It didn't look like your name anymore. But if you scribble it bad enough, you don't have to worry about how it spells out. Go ahead, Nancy.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, I'm here today, and my name is Nancy Latini. I'm the Assistant Superintendent at the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships at the Department of Education. And I'm here today to offer some suggestions, recommendations for House Bill 2450 related to the High-Cost Disability Fund. The department has a committee, it's been an ongoing committee, on finance and accountability in special education. For this past year, we've been meeting specifically around the high-cost disability fund, looking at ways that schools were going to make their submissions on the cost, making sure that we kept schools in reporting in an accurate way, and some of the rules around, the business rules around those submissions. We met at the end of February, right after your last hearing on this bill, and carefully looked at the submissions from the districts to see actually what we really had. And the committee came up with some recommendations that I'm here to share with you today. First one was to remove the sunset. They feel this bill is going to work and is working for asking for special funds for districts that have the high-cost disabled students in their school districts. They would like to keep the allocation at $12 million as it is. However, what they do believe after looking at the submissions is to raise the bar from $25,000 to $30,000 so that a high-cost student would be at $30,000 or above. What this does is actually removes almost 50% of the students that were submitted. There were about 1,900 students, I believe, and it would remove about 50% of them. And as Mr. Hunsinger said at the last hearing, that does reduce an amount of paperwork for districts with kids at that level. We're also wanting to be sure, although we made the assumption and we can assure you that it's happened, we need to make sure in our directions that districts are obligated to spend the double weight of every student before they even submit any kind of a claim. And we'll make sure that we know it's happened, we've double checked it, but we want to make sure that's in our.
And so that new double weight would be $60,000, is that correct?
No, it would be the double weight for the student, the ADM double weight.
Oh, the ADM.
Yeah,
okay.
And making sure that that is spent first before they consider the student high cost. So what happens is there are fewer students that would be eligible for these funds, but the district submitting would get a closer rate to the 100% for the benefit for the truly high cost students, which is what we were looking for. I've asked Mr. Hunsinger to come and talk about some of the other specifics that the committee has made recommendations for.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, First of all, it's a pleasure to serve on this committee, and I believe that that when we looked at the data, that what Nancy Latini just talked about, what we found was that instead of getting 70% or 65% of the money at the limit of $25,000, that they would be getting 100% at the limit of $30,000, and that the district dollars didn't change appreciably. So, like, you took Portland, it was a big gainer in this. I think their dollars went down by about $120,000 out of almost $2 million. So very, very small changes, and it does away with a lot of paperwork. So we certainly like that. The other thing that the committee talked about is that as you deal with $30,000, you'd have to know that over time, that as school costs go up, that you would be very quickly back in the same circumstance again, where you would have not 100%, they're close to 100%, but it would gradually go down as school costs went up and more students got above the 30,000, and you would eventually be back into a smaller percentage. And the committee recommended that there be some type of an inflation factor put on this amount, and that it go up accordingly. So if you could take some inflation index, the cost of living index or whatever, and apply it to this factor over time, that it would serve you well, and you might not have to revisit it down the road.
So, Kent, that's just an inflation factor on the $30,000 that's being proposed now.
That's correct.
Mr. Kenny. Questions of either Ms. Latini or Ken Hunsaker? Thank you both very much. We appreciate your testimony today, and that's been vetted then in the ODE then with your office, Ms. Latini. Thank you very kindly. Any questions of staff relative to the possibility of an inflation factor on the proposed $30,000? Where else do we use inflation factors in the education community? And what factors do we use?
Mr. Chair, we don't use any inflation factors in the school formula at all right now. Several different ones have been proposed, but there's always been a cost to making it a state only and pertain to school districts in that process. So I'm not aware of any that just deals with school districts that is provided on an ongoing basis. There's good special studies, but I don't know of any that is consistently produced.
You know, there's another factor, and that is this is relative to high-cost disabilities. And, yes. Of course, if you look at that, how much of that is medically related,
right,
which is a considerably higher inflation factor than the CPI kind of inflation factor.
That's very possible. And also, Mr. Chair, since these are high-cost students that deal with a lot of labor costs, and so I think that would be one of the primary costs involved, and you would want some kind of factor that would take that into account as well.
Okay. I'll just ask those present in the various communities to put on their thinking cap as to what kind of, keeping in mind that you've got both the high-cost disabilities, which is in some respects medically related, and then also the fact that you, as staff has indicated, that it is also in relationship to the labor factor, which seems to scale up a little bit faster than standard inflation CPI rates. Other discussion relative to House Bill 2450. Please, go right ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, as part of your packet today, you do have a table, Simulation 10, that I produced, trying to compare what current law numbers would be at the governor's budget level by school district, with current law being without a small high school fund and also without a high-cost disability grant in the formula. Compare that to House Bill 2450. I learned just before the meeting today that Beaverton will qualify for a high-cost grant of about $500,000, and so that makes the high-cost numbers in this table wrong. Each of these would be reduced probably by roughly 4% once Beaverton is included in those numbers. You can see that The total amount under House Bill 2450 is the $3.88.5 million, and under current law it's only $3.4484, or a $100,000 difference. That is because of ESDs coming into play with their 5%. Under current law, they get 5% of that additional, that money that would be there under House Bill 2450. Since it's going to the small high schools, that share would not be part of ESD funding. So there's a $100,000 difference there overall. The incorporates some of the new data that the Department of Education has just put out yesterday, I guess, but it's still subject to change, one for the governor's budget, and two as other data is updated probably this month, yet reviewing some of the local revenue and student count numbers.
Thank you very much, Steve. Other questions, Representative Comp?
Just a question about the $25,000 cost and as compared to the $30,000 figure, because in the statutes it said it should be under Section 3, but Chairman Butler, could you help show me where that would be, or is it listed and I just can't find it? In
The $30,000 replacement?
Yes.
It would come in more than one place.
Okay.
Let's see.
It's already in statute. So
right, it's in statute.
25 is in statute. I'm not sure that that's in the bill itself.
I can't find it in the bill.
I don't see it.
It's not in the bill.
No, it's not in the bill. It doesn't have to be in the bill because of the way you're just removing the sunset.
Right.
And not changing that. So that section of statutes would have to be added to amend it.
Okay. Right. Thank you for that clarification.
But you were also looking for the $25,000 in the bill.
No, it's in the statute.
It's in the statute.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Berger?
Steve, now go through again because I'm slow. The difference between this simulation, it includes the $30,000.
It does not.
It does not.
No, this is at as the bill is drafted with the $25,000 being in it.
Okay.
And what's the difference between this simulation and the one I had of February 11th?
The data has been updated, and especially under the high cost, with the actual cost for 0203. So the assumption is that ongoing, that those costs, future costs, will be proportional to what it was for 0203.
Okay. So I can throw this one away.
The old one?
Old news.
Okay.
Get out the
news. So simulation 10 is the most current, but that does not include the fact that Beaverton would qualify for a high-cost disability grant.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Okay.
And the amount of that high-cost disability, do we know?
For Beaverton, about $500,000. I don't have the exact number.
Okay. Representative Berger?
A comment, if I may. This speaks to how quickly things change in interesting ways when we look at these simulations, that it's sort of a moving point always, depending on outside of here. So these simulations are kind of a snapshot, and we need to remember that.
Don't take this home. Don't take this home to your district in 3 months and tell them what they're going to get.
Right.
Of course, most of our districts have pretty good access to this information from the legislative revenue as well.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hess,
let's just have a referral to Ways and Means.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Well, I guess my question would be why, if it's all within the formula. There's no fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hess, I don't have an answer for that question.
Yes, Representative.
I believe, Representative Hess, it does have a fiscal impact, because if we don't pass this bill, then the high-cost disability grant and will sunset and go away. So, and that would have a fiscal impact in the small school.
But isn't it all within the formula? I think is the question.
Oh, you're right. It would. Because it doesn't change. Good point.
It would still have to, in order to modify the maximum or the baseline of the $25,000 to $30,000, and in order to extend the sunset, we'd have to pass it here. It needs to go to the various chambers.
Yeah, I don't.
Murphy, that's a good question. We'll follow up with the speaker's office to see if we can get that subsequent referral removed. Because it really has no effect on the expenditures, but does have two very substantive issues that we need to address. Thank you very much. Other questions of staff relative to 2450? Hearing and seeing none, colleagues will stand adjourned until tomorrow evening time. Thank you very much. Close that.